Hello, and welcome back to another edition of the Three Good Things podcast, where, you guessed it, we talk about three good things. I'm Ferdul, and today we have a guest for our podcast, the amazing Kat Cole. Welcome to the podcast, Kat.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Kat is a seasoned leader and operator with a track record of turning around companies and building brands, teams, and high-growth businesses over two decades. As COO and president of Focus Brands, the owner, franchisor, and operator of global limited service food brands, doing billions in product sales in over 50 countries, she leads the company's seven brands: Cinnabon, Auntie Anne's, Moe's, Schlotzky's, McAllister's, Carvel, and Jamba, with 6,500 operations globally and leading the multi-brand licensing and CPG businesses. Kat is a young global leader of the World Economic Forum, a member of the Milk Bar Board of Directors, I still need to try Milk Bar myself, to be quite honest, an advisor to high-growth businesses, and a mom of two. Kat's a member of the United Nations Global Entrepreneurs Council. She was featured on CBS's Undercover Boss and was named one of Fortune's 40 Under 40. She's a college dropout, but she has an MBA in international business. Her journey from restaurant hostess at 17, executive by 26, president by 31, and investor by 35 is often shared as an example of the American and entrepreneurial dream. Outside of food service, Kat is an angel investor, an advisor to early stage consumer product and DTC companies, and an outspoken advocate for women's issues and the broader role of business in democratizing access to education and opportunities for everyone. She's also the host of Office Hours here on Clubhouse every Wednesday, which is an amazing session, if you haven't been, where she talks about mentoring and helping other people. Whew, that was a lot, but there we go. All right. Yeah. Fantastic to have you on the podcast. I think we've been trying to get time together for quite some time.
Yeah, so glad it worked out.
I actually wanted to dive in. How did we meet? Do you have any funny stories?
No. I mean, we met on Clubhouse. So, you know, people connecting, people helping people, man.
Yeah. No, it's funny because that's the extent of the guests that I've had. I think the last like five or six guests have just been people that I've never met in real life that I've either met on Clubhouse or through Twitter, etc. And I've just kind of followed up with them. Our second thing is, what's your story? I kind of love asking this question because we went through your bio, which is kind of what everyone writes about and kind of your career. But what's your story in your words?
You know, my story is, I think, like everyone's, you know, got unexpected twists and turns, and it's ever changing. I'm pretty passionate about this concept of permission to change. And I'm on a journey, and, you know, my mom has written notes on my birthday cards for many years. And I put these quotes together to form this phrase that describes my story and is a mantra that I live by and what I apply to teams and my own relationships, to myself and to the businesses I run, which is, don't forget where you came from, but don't you dare ever let it solely define you. Our truth is in our roots, but our past is not our jail. And I think that that phrase or that mantra is my story. And it really covers growing up in Jacksonville. I'm the oldest of three girls. I have two younger sisters. When I was 9 years old, my mom came to me and said, "That's it, I'm done, we're leaving." And what she meant was we were leaving my dad. He was an alcoholic, really sweet man, but an alcoholic and a terrible husband and father. I had been in three car accidents by the time I was 9 years old. So I knew it was bad. And one of the most formative moments of my life, when I look back, I didn't know it then, but as I've reflected, was that moment when she said we were leaving, because much to her surprise, I did not cry or get upset. I looked and said, "What took you so long?" at the age of 9. And the lesson I take from that is that people who are closest to the action, you know, me being the daughter who was in car accidents with an alcoholic father, and all the other things that came along with having an alcoholic father, you know, I was so close to the action. I knew in my gut, I knew it was better to be somewhere else. But because I was the child and not the parent, or in the case of business, you know, the employee, not the leader, I didn't have the language to articulate the problem or the solution, and I didn't have the authority to do something about it. As a nine-year-old, only my mom did, and in business, only the leaders do. And so that is one of the many things of my background that I reference when I say, don't forget where you came from, but don't let it solely define you. I'll never forget that. It is, in fact, my father and that experience with him that helped me have the experiences I would then have, which was having to be a leader in my own family at a young age, seeing my mom feed us on a food budget of $10 a week for years, and being incredibly resourceful, having to start working very early, which inevitably led to a career trajectory that likely would not have happened otherwise. So I don't forget my past. I honor it, but it doesn't define me. I'm not trapped by it. It's not my jail. And so that is my story, right? And I started working really early, and then it led to an unexpected career in food service and franchising and restaurants. First person in my family to get into college. So I'm one of those kids. No one on either side of my family had ever gone to college. Most of the people on either side of my family were junkers or factory workers or truck drivers or, you know, and veterans. And so, you know, good, honest blue collar work, or they were on drugs or in jail. And so being different, whatever different meant, anything that was different felt right and good to me. And so my story is one of growth, of learning. My currency is learning. It is learning above all else, because that felt like the ticket out of that situation. And my mom always encouraged that in me so that I could be independent. That's all she wanted for her three girls, was for us to grow up and not need anyone. If we wanted someone, great, but she didn't want us to have to rely on someone in the way that she did, and why she stayed with my father for so many years. And that independence led to me taking a lot of leadership roles and everything that I've done in my life very naturally. And then that led to a series of professional steps that I'm sure we'll get into. So that's my story.
Fantastic. Yeah. I did a little bit of my own research, saw some videos of your background. But you mentioned kind of being thrust into, you know, the situation that you had when you were very young, and having to be a child who had so many things going on within the family life. But then also a couple years later, as a teenager, you started working at Hooters as a hostess. And that was like your first stint of work. I guess kind of on that side, of how much of that shaped you as a person now, and looking back at it, you know, years later, what made you kind of decide, like, I want to be working, and then I want to go work at Hooters?
So my first job wasn't hostess at Hooters. It was actually working in a mall when I was 15 and cleaning gym equipment. Okay. And so it was my third job, and I had three jobs for 2 years. I kept the other jobs, and being a hostess, it wasn't that I wanted to. I mean, I did want to. I wanted to work. I wanted to be independent. I had to. You know, there was no money. So if I wanted a car, if I wanted to pay for insurance for that car, pay for gas for that car, and pay for school, since I was the first person to get into college, I had to work. I enjoyed working, but the impetus for it wasn't solely I want to work, right? It was I want to be independent, and independence and choice to a degree requires some type of income, and I didn't have any. So I had to work more than the average person, and I did, and I enjoyed it though. So I had to, but I enjoyed it. And then why Hooters? It was a restaurant. It is a restaurant. Back then, I think it was only 17% of the sales were from alcohol. So many people think it is this bar. If they haven't been there, it had a smaller percentage of alcohol sales than Fridays and Applebee's. So despite whatever people might think, it's a casual dining restaurant. And I think it's maybe gotten up to 22 or 23% of sales, at least when I left 10 years ago. And so it was a restaurant. And one out of two people in the United States have their first job or an early job in restaurants and hospitality. So that in and of itself wasn't unusual, but it was Hooters and not Applebee's. And so I think there were a few things that led to that. One, I was recruited. There were people who would go into malls with people who were working in the service industry already in retail, because there are a lot of overlapping skills that make sense to be a waitress. And someone came in and gave me a Hooters recruiter card. Literally, that's what it said. It had an owl on it. And they said, hey, you should, you know, come in and work a couple shifts. And we're always looking for people who are customer service minded. Come in. And I thought, oh, that's cool. I mean, I grew up in Jacksonville. Hooters had been there for a long time. It was the one I ended up working at was the third one in the system. And so it just wasn't that big of a deal. It was Florida, you know, people wear less clothes on the beach. Just, I really did not understand what a big deal it was until, or at least what a controversial topic it could be until I was older and in more professional settings. Because if you work there, you know, newsflash, everybody wants to be there. You know, the employees want to be there. The customers that are there want to be there. It was a ton of fun. Women were incredibly empowered. Over half of the managers were women because they worked their way up from within. What a lot of people don't realize, but I know benefited me, is every leader I worked for in that company as I grew until I worked for the CEO was a woman. Every wow. leader. And so boss after boss was a woman. And so the unexpected benefit of that is that once I got into boardrooms, once I started sitting in meetings, I was never trying to figure out how to be a woman in a man's world. I had always been a leader in a woman's world. I saw quiet leaders, loud leaders, educated leaders, scrappy leaders. You know, you name it, but they were, so many of them were women. So I wasn't trying to find my way in as much as many others. The bigger issue is that I was young as a leader. But the number of women leaders that I had, because of how many worked their way up from within, surprises many people. But when you think about it, 100% of the front of house staff is female. And many companies and restaurants promote from within. So the pipeline is largely female. And so that was a really great experience. But I didn't plan on working at Hooters, and I didn't plan on working in restaurants my whole life. I was the first person in my family to get into college. I was an electrical engineering and computer sciences major, a psychology of women minor. My plan was to get my engineering degree and then go to law school. And it just so happened that Hooters was growing around the world. And after being a hostess at 17 and a waitress at 18, and year of college when I was 19, I was asked to be a part of the training team to go open the first ever Hooters in Australia. I'd never been on a plane. I did not have a passport. I'd only been out of the state of Florida a couple of times for athletic competitions. And yet I still said yes, bought my first plane ticket, flew to Miami, stood in line with my paperwork, got a passport expedited, and then a few weeks later left to go launch the franchise in Sydney, Australia. I came back, made up my classes from college that I missed while I was gone for 40 days, and thought that would be it. But it actually turned into a career of opening franchises around the world in the following 12 months. And then when I was 20, traveling so much that I was failing college. So I dropped out of school, took a corporate job at Hooters, moved to Atlanta, and then grew on the corporate side of restaurants and franchising. And so first corporate gig at 20, was vice president of the company by 26 when we were doing between $700 and $800 million in revenue, helped grow the company around the world, helped put in amazing systems, launch crazy products and programs. We were fully vertically integrated, which many people don't know. So we owned our own manufacturing, our own supply chain, our own direct distribution network, our own marketing company, our own advertising company. And I had the ability, working within that company, to be exposed to all of these verticals of industries. And it's one of the many reasons I stayed as long as I did. And I will be forever grateful for it. You know, it's was Hooters. So it's not as if there were Wharton MBAs beating down the door trying to get a management gig at Hooters corporate office. And I knew that. And I was grateful for having opportunities so early. I knew good and well that with my lack of education, my background, and then add to that the fact that I had worked at Hooters, that an ordinary company would not have given a 19-year-old the opportunity to open a business around the world, or the job of overseeing a corporate training department at 20 or 21, And that may sound risky, but I did a really good job. And there were great people who believed in me, who supported me. And I wasn't afraid to ask for help. And so that whole career, that part of the arc of my career being there, was far more complex than people realize because of the complexity of vertical integration and all the industries that were housed under the company, because of the growth trajectory that we had, because of my personal growth within the company, and then my eventual departure to become president of another global company, Cinnabon, at the age of 31.
Got it. So when you became an executive at such a young age after dropping out, how did you go about kind of learning so many different things? And something that I'm always interested in is learning more about how people face adversity. And you've just talked about many different instances of adversity over time. But when you're new to the different verticals, maybe you're really young, how did you kind of take that adversity and make it your own and kind of try to make sure that you have not only a seat at the table, but also people that are willing and trying to get people to align and listen to what you have to say?
One of the things that was a product, I think, of me being young and a benefit is that I wasn't, it's both my personality, but I think I felt more permission because I was so young at the table that I felt the permission to ask questions. I didn't feel this weight, this expectation to know it all. I felt a weight to not let people down who put me there, who supported me. I felt a weight to figure it out, but I didn't feel pressure to know it all. And that concept of a humble confidence, right? I know I can figure it out. That doesn't mean I think I know everything and that I know the answer. I just believe in my ability to ask for help, to get it, to try things, to serve others. And for all of that, when you put it into a cauldron, to turn into really good outcomes. And there's got to be a part of that that was because I was young, because I thought, well, of course I'm young, and of course I'm going to ask questions. This is my first time leading a team, and people know that. And so I felt a lightness of an openness to ask questions, not to be a little lamb and ask people to do my job, but to ask for guidance, to ask for perspective, to ask for help. And two things happened when I did that. One, I was colored by the thinking and the experiences of everyone that I asked. And people, as they saw me implementing what they shared, wanted to see me succeed, or they wanted to be on my team. And so they were helpers in many ways. They were helpers in information, but they were also helpers in being advocates or supporters. And there's something about bringing a humble confidence, a confidence that isn't, you know, so much swagger that you're knocking people out of the way, but rather my head is held high. My shoulders are back, but my hands are open. You know, I'm there, I'm confidently there, but I'm asking for help. And that was part of the key to my growth in the early days. It was part of navigating boardrooms where people were twice or almost three times my age, where in most cases they had been in business longer than I had been alive, literally. and there was something about that that was a little bit intimidating. Some of that was in my head. Other times some people were actually trying to intimidate me, you know, that is real, and make me feel unwelcome because they weren't used to someone who looked like my background, who wasn't like them. And, so that was, you know, that was hard. It was lonely sometimes, but I found joy in the work. You know, I loved opening businesses. I loved my teams. I had the deepest respect for my franchisees who were putting their life savings into these businesses. And so I found a way to put my energy where it matters, which is the people I served, and not put too much of my energy into bosses and, you know, patriarchal peers and leaders. And, but that took some time to learn that.
Got it. I think one thing that you just touched on is those times when you were either intimidated or you weren't sure. I'm really curious to get your perspective on when to ask for help and when, and kind of your decision calculus of when should I go to ask someone for help on X subject? And when should I tell them, hey, I've got it, let me take care of this myself? Especially at like a very high level as an executive, you can't, like you mentioned, you can't always be in like that lamb perspective of always telling people to, you know, come do my job. It's, you have to find that balance. So what was your decision calculus of when to ask for help versus leading by example?
You know, one thing, I'll go with the second part first, is as a leader, I'm never saying, I've got this, I'm going to do it by myself, right? The question is, are there scenarios where I need more guidance, more help, or where I need to lead? Or said another way, I believe that the humans who show up best in the world have the greatest command of these four mindsets, which is humility and curiosity on one side. They're cousins of each other, but they're not the same thing. And courage and confidence on the other. Again, cousins of each other, similar, related, but not the same. And humility is just this very clear belief that others can teach me and that I don't know and I can learn and grow. Curiosity, of course, the willingness and the act of inquiring and asking. So you can be super humble and think there are a lot of things you don't know, but actually not engage in the act of asking and learning. So they're different in that way and very important that they be paired with each other. And then courage and confidence, you know, courage, the willingness to do uncomfortable things. And confidence is this mindset of I can figure it out, not I know it, not I'm right. That's different, but I can figure it out. And so I do believe my shining moments as a leader and then my darkest moments as a leader have been defined by my ability to have command of and control of and use those mindsets in the optimal blend. Some situations call for some to be turned up and some to be turned down. And then there's this other piece, which is knowing how to state my boundaries if they need to be stated. And so while I am humble, while I am curious, that is my default. But when you're young, and that's your default, you also have a risk of being walked over or not acknowledged in a space. So there have been times where I have needed my actions, my decisions said everything that needed to be said. But there have been times I've had to literally say, do not confuse my kindness and curiosity for stupidity. Mm. Or do not confuse my kindness and humility for lack of decisiveness. I have had to look people in the eye and say that. I don't make a big deal about it. I say it and we move on. And I've only a handful of times have I had to outright say that, which is my way of gracefully telling someone you're overstepping and you're misinterpreting. You know, don't lean into because I'm young, because I'm not like you, because I don't have the education and I'm asking for help to mean that I'm helpless. And so for anyone who's hearing my over-indexing of humility and curiosity, I want to encourage anyone to use that tool if they feel it's needed to be used and not to dwell on it, but you're drawing a line. At the same time, there are times where people would expect that I know what to do or have worked with other people who simply don't ask for help. And I ask for feedback. And when I ask for help, sometimes it's just perspective. I'm not asking for, like, I'm lifting a box. I need you to put your hand under it and help me lift. I'm lifting a box and I'm asking you, do you think I should lift it 2 inches higher or 2 inches lower? Or should I, you know, when you've lifted boxes, how have you done it? I'm asking for perspective. I'm asking for advice and counsel. And yes, I am asking for literal help. Wow, we're navigating this. We've run into something I didn't expect. I need you to weigh in on it. That is a very confident way to be humble and curious, right? I'm leading this. This is what we've run into. I'm dealing with something that I haven't navigated before, or there's something that comes up that really warrants your expertise. I'd love to know what you think. There is nothing about that that sounds helpless, yet I'm asking for help. And there's a way to continue to let people know, I'm not lost. I've got your back. I'm going to help us through this while being open and requesting all the minds that are needed at the table. And I remember I was the chair of the board of a restaurant association, a small nonprofit that's an industry organization that represents small, independent, and mid-sized chain restaurateurs in Georgia. And when I took it over, I was 26 or 27. I was a new vice president in my own company, and I'd been on this board for 2 years and then was asked to raise my hand to chair the board. I'd never had governance training. I had only observed the behaviors of the board I had participated in. And I said yes, and I inherited a pretty messy situation in that board, lots of things that needed to be changed, including the board's leadership, including some of the legal support, like some kind of shady stuff going on. And I reached out to a CEO who had earlier sent me a congratulations note for becoming the chair of the board. And he basically just said, hey, I helped start this nonprofit back in the day, back when it was just a few of us sitting around a table looking for industry advocacy. I'm very proud of the organization. It means a lot to me. If you ever need help, if I can support you in any way, let me know. And it turns out I actually did need help because I was navigating uncharted waters with power dynamics that I was not familiar with many people trying to protect their own ways of working that were not serving the business. And it was icky. I mean, there were just parts of it that were uncomfortable and gave me anxiety. And I was nervous as a young leader, not wanting to let the board down, knowing I wasn't alone, but that it was ultimately my decision to put certain things in motion. And I would have to be working outside of some of the company's leadership and some of the board members because of the nature of the issues. And so I reached out to the CEO and said, look, I'd love your advice. And I met him, and he gave me some incredible encouragement and advice and offered future support. And it just gave me the nudge. You know, it gave me a little bit of the confidence I needed. I mean, I had a strong spine, but it gave me a little bit of a back brace. And he gave me a few tips and some names of people to call that would be supportive if it got a little messy from a legal perspective. And that's not even my day job, right? That was just a nonprofit I was leading. But some of my biggest leadership experiences have come from leading people I don't pay, leading nonprofits, leading people who are aligned around a mission, who are navigating causes. I was the chair of a board when the CEO of an organization that I was leading, who was my mentor, died suddenly. And having to navigate that organization, passing the torch to the chair that was succeeding me, and helping that organization, the CEO's beloved, helping them grieve through this process while trying to communicate externally to the industry, who had invested millions of dollars in this women's leadership organization, that we've got it, your money is in good hands. Boy, I was asking for help left and right from many leaders that I had met along the way. And it just so happened I had dealt with the sudden death of the CEO in my own company and had some experience in navigating grief, plus keeping the business on the tracks, plus what has to be signaled externally. So I couldn't have navigated those with as much confidence without asking for advice and help.
Got it. Wow. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out the best way to segue if we can, but I think you touched on a bunch of awesome things there. And I think what's a question I have kind of as a follow-up to what you're just talking about is, when you have something that's going on either in your personal life or within your own company, but at the same time you have to show up as a leader or someone who is, you know, let's just say kind of on a pedestal, whether you're working in a humanitarian effort or people that are not necessarily, working for you, how do you kind of mentally change your mindset to put maybe the things that you're currently dealing with aside and make it about the people that are in front of you, whether that's nonprofit or even a lot of humanitarian work as well? What's your kind of mental framework to approach that situation?
I think the first part of the mental model is, should it be put aside or not? I've never found it optimal to hide my humanity. But that doesn't mean that there aren't things that have been very personal in my journey that I have kept to myself. There are those things that happen to us. I've had several miscarriages, and my husband and my journey to have babies. We have two wonderful babies. We've had several miscarriages in that process. And I was negotiating one of the largest acquisitions for our company as COO and president, flying from one meeting to another when it happened. And I did not tell anyone. That was something that I kept to my, I'm very comfortable talking about it publicly because it's so normal. And I knew it was normal then. It doesn't mean it wasn't sad as shit, right? And I'm like super upset and hurting and disappointed and not able to be in the arms of my partner and process that at home. And so my grieving had to be a bit delayed and prolonged. And that wasn't something that I, you know, to work. I was the COO and am the COO and president of the company. This was not that long ago. Had to show up to the meeting. I was in good health. You know, there was nothing physical that I was compromising by doing this. It was just mentally, I had to find a way to put it on pause so that I could focus. And I did. And we all have to do those things sometimes. And I'm not saying that if someone has something like that happen, that they would not be supported for taking a day. Right? You have to do what's right for you. But I knew my body was safe. It was not my first miscarriage. So I understood that it was my body's way of processing something that would not have been healthy. And I was okay. But that's the type of thing where for me in that moment, that is the instance where I needed to put it aside. But I did it by crying that night, talking to my husband, meditating, talking to the universe, processing it, realizing that I and life and things were going to go on and that I would be okay in this meeting. And I'm not suggesting everyone would have to do that. At the same time, there have been other things that I've dealt with that I did not feel the need in that moment, something so private, so personal, to not bring up where I would share. And I have supported many leaders through all kinds of trauma and journey and evolution. And so I think it's important if it's something that is going to show that you're navigating and you're human to find your own way. Again, this is such a personal decision. So I'll just say what I've done. I find a way to let people know what I'm comfortable with them knowing for two reasons. One, I would be further devastated if my team or my customers or any stakeholders misinterpreted what I'm processing as something that has to do with them, right? If I were sad or a little edgy or something were going on, and then they think it's them because I haven't shared that I'm navigating something. And I care so much about my team that as long as I don't feel that I'm burdening with them with something or going into too much detail, that sharing a little, one of the benefits is it removes some of the likelihood that whatever might be the outcome of what I'm processing is misinterpreted as having to do with them. The second reason I am so comfortable with bringing my humanity and want others to be comfortable bringing their humanity is it is amazing how people step up to support you, whether that's literally with what you're dealing with or just giving you some space or saying, you know what, that meeting we were going to have, like really, if you want to take a longer lunch, it's totally cool. Like you don't have to be in there. Or why don't you let me switch times of the interview and I'll do the interview with that candidate today and you can take my space tomorrow. Those are the little things that can happen when we bring our humanity. And but that requires a culture, of course, where that is welcome. But I believe that culture is most likely to exist when the leaders are comfortable doing that. And then others see that it's okay and they find their own way to do that. So it's rarely is it the first version that I described, you know, something that I just keep to myself and I got to keep going. And later I actually held town halls and talked about loss in one of our garage talks at our company. And I talked about that miscarriage. And so I would later bring it up in a very appropriate way in an appropriate forum, but just not in that moment. But many other times I've shared, just, hey, this is going on or that's going on, or worked with other leaders who have done that so beautifully and so gracefully and seen the benefits.
Yeah, you mentioned culture. And as someone that's worked at Cinnabon and then now at Focus Brands, What advice do you have for people that are trying to create that culture of vulnerability, humility, making sure that people can take time when they need to, and make sure that everyone is taken care of from every single aspect that they need to care for? I don't know if I worded that properly, but I think you get what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is culture starts at the top. And so having policies or, you know, having memos or things that come out that encourage people to do things is important. But it all starts with what I just described, the behavior of the leader. People read between the lines. Just because the policy says, take a mental health day, don't stress yourself out, we don't want burnout. If they see the leader doing that or others who are celebrated in the organization, they will either A, mimic those behaviors out of a desire to be like that person from a status perspective, or they will feel guilted into doing it. And especially if the employment environment isn't robust, if they need this job, which many do, then they will put themselves in positions because they are reading between the lines, watching behaviors of, and identifying the gaps between what people say and what they do. Mm. And so it's just do it. Like, that's my answer for everything. You want to have a culture of inclusion? Be inclusive. You want to have a culture of diversity? Hire diversity. Have diverse vendors. You want to have a culture where people don't stress themselves out? Don't stress yourself out and other people out. Have forums for people to connect. Provide flexibility. Have, you know, a really set, like a diverse thought at the policymaking table for the company so that people with very different lived experiences can express what's important. I'll give you one perfect example. I've been running companies since a very young age. Most of my peers and all those who make decisions, almost all of them, if they have children, they are grown up. And so here I am, I was 37 when I had my first baby, had been a president for many years, was now COO, managing multiple presidents. And there was no one at the table that could empathize with my lived experience as a mother of an infant, a parent of an infant, because they all had kids in their 20s and 30s, 40s in some cases. And so it doesn't mean that they weren't empathetic. It doesn't mean that they weren't thoughtful, but things that would have been easier conversations to have to bring my full experience forward would have been more fluid if there were facilitated conversations of people with more types of lived experiences. Now, of course, I then created that space and facilitated that, but it didn't exist before. We were moving into a new headquarters at the same time, and it's like, where are the pump rooms? Where's this? Where, you know, these little things that when the lived experience is not represented at the table, lots of little things that become big things get lost. Structure dictates function, and the way people function is the culture. The way we do, the way we be, the way we are with each other when no one's in the room, what we say is allowed here, what we say isn't allowed here, what we don't say, right? That's all culture. And it really does start with the leader or the leadership team and how they show up every day. And then the varied lived experiences, the more the better, that contribute to form and function that then is the container for culture.
Totally. Something that I recently have started learning a little bit more about, just out of curiosity, is the difference between signals and perception. And I think you touched on this briefly, is just because like a policy says that you can take a day, or you know, something says that you can take some time off, what people observe and what their perception is and the signals that we see our leaders do, we mimic. And similarly, not even from a employee leader perspective, but just from a general peer perspective, whatever signals that you send out, you're sending those out because you want to, or you may not want to. And the perception of how someone's receiving a message or a nonverbal message is crazy sometimes, because you may be sending out signals that you did not realize that you're sending out at all. And the way that someone else perceives those is very different compared to what you necessarily meant to send. So when it comes to like building that culture, I think when we see leaders that are embodying some of the cultural values that you want to create at the company, and then actually living those, it's a lot bigger than seeing a policy and a sentence on a piece of paper or on a PDF. I have the ability to actually go observe them. And I think in general, humans are creatures of habit. So when you see someone that is a leader that is building that culture and actually living that culture, it's a lot more impactful than just reading it on a piece of paper.
I think leaders, you know, we just have to remember whether it's a startup and a team of two, a team of 20, hundreds or thousands, we still have to all be on a journey. And the larger the organization, the farther you are from reality of the business. I mean, even if you're going from a team of three and you're one of the people answering the phones for customer care for your small business that's growing, by the time you have 10 people, you're not answering the phones anymore, right? Mm-hmm. You're one layer removed. And so sometimes when we have these conversations, people think, problem at, you know, at bigger companies. It's not. I mentor a lot of founders. I invest in startups, people at all stages. We all go through these evolutions. And part of the answer of demystifying what's going on and decoding what might be perception or signaling or those things you mentioned is just always talking about why. And I was talking to a founder of a super high growth startup that I met on Clubhouse, actually. And we were talking about this dynamic of the first time when you start bringing in some professional hires from the outside that aren't your OG team, like aren't your original crew, you know, the small crew that did everything in the early days. And as the business grows, especially if it grows rapidly, there will be people in many cases who are not the right person to keep promoting into the next larger roles. And boy, those are hard moments. And they're hard moments from a startup perspective, but they're still even hard for me. You know, as we grow our organization and there are people who've been with us and then sitting down and saying, you know, look, there's this role that's coming up. Here's where you're very strong. This is what we need. And so we're going to be looking for it, you know, outside, or I know you and I have had conversations about this, and I do believe you can get there, but not in the time that we need. And just talking to people one-on-one, which requires being thoughtful about the perceptions that people have. It requires being in tune with what their expectations might be, having one-on-one or one-on-few forums for feedback, and then picking up the signals very, you know, literally, or the themes that you're kind of picking up from the vibe and being vulnerable and open, whether it's in town halls or in these one-on-one meetings, to just talk about the why behind things. Because in the absence of alternative information, people come to their own conclusions about everything. And rarely is it the positive spin on things. It's human. And so it is that those growth stages, culture is not static. You know, just because it's good at one point doesn't mean it's good forever. We've all seen the stories of that. Many of us have lived it in companies, and especially in high growth, there are more people coming from the outside year over year than were in it the year before. That's like radically culture changing. And if you put the right guardrails in place, that can be quite beautiful because the culture evolves and morphs and grows in a way that it needs to, contributed to by the new folks and the folks that are still in the company. But man, can people feel invisible and looked over. And then to your point, filling in the gaps of why things are happening because nobody else is giving them an alternative, credible, truthful, candid explanation that applies to them or generally fills in the gaps. And that is even harder in remote first teams. And certainly for those that are still navigating a distributed team world, it's easier for people to feel invisible. It's harder for people to pick up on the vibe. So more literal conversations on their role, the company's growth, you know, here's where you're strong, here's where I think you can get, but here's what we need. So here's what I'm doing. I want to be sure you are on the same page as to why. Sometimes people need to be moved out of the company because it's best for them. and the company, and having that I would be failing you if mentality, like I would be failing you if I just let you here, you know, let you sit here and squat in this role while I know good and well the company should have someone that has different skills that are right-sized for where we are. I would be saying I left you here. But if you were a part of the people, you know, part of the group that brought us to the dance, then I need to find a way to take care of you. And I need to find a way to make sure you have a soft landing. And the way I often approach that is giving people as much notice as I can. And I was talking to a major VC, like one of the top four. And I was like, I was asking him about an investment that I'm looking at being an advisor to and on the board of. And I'm like, I know they're great because you've obviously invested in them. What are the watch outs? And he said, nothing different than any other company we invest in, because by the time we invest, you know, they've proven themselves. There's no risk of if they don't get their next round, they're going out of business. The question is, can they keep skilling and leveling up the team to fit and drive the growth? And like you look at any of the companies that have made it through, they don't always have the only version of that great idea. But the founders and the leaders and the team they build around them keep finding a way up. He said sometimes every quarter, like the growth is that rapid. Every quarter, every 6 months, or every year, there is a meaningful evolution of the team's capabilities, either because they're helping their team members grow, if they can grow and meet those needs, and or they're bringing in people from the outside. And as he was saying that, you know, my heart, I feel that culture. It's like a car going really fast, and there's a lot of people in the car, and it's okay if the wheels shake, but it is not okay if they come off. People can be nervous. They should not be scared, right? They can be a little, they can be anticipatory of where they're going, but they shouldn't feel lost.
Got it.
Is culture. That is the leader's role, to sort between these dynamics of what you're bringing up, signaling, perception, and just talk about why. Don't leave it unsaid or assumed.
You mentioned how some of the, even your companies, especially as well as just general companies, are kind of adapting to, and I hate this phrase because I think everyone is saying it and it's just like, it's something that everyone says, like adapting to the new normal and quarantine and things like that. But one question I have for you before we jump into our learning segment and then to lightning round, and then we'll have people up to the speaker box to ask questions. One question I have is, what are three things that have helped you during this quarantine time?
One thing that's helped me is just my husband and family. You know, that it's hard, it's stressful with two babies under three and a husband who's, you know, at his own sort of rapid arc in his work life, raising a second fund for his firm. But just the joy, like finding the joy between the stressful moments of the fact that I get to spend more time with my family and than I likely otherwise would have. And that I know that as a company, we are also encouraging and making it as flexible as we can for all of our team members so they can do the same without stress. We've got a whole team of people who are, every week they give us ideas. Like we've blocked out 5 hours in a week where no one is allowed to schedule meetings.
That's awesome.
That came from our team members. And then after, I think it's 3 on Fridays, also no meetings. And just that contribution, like I'm grateful for the lived experience. That's what's helped me through, you know, at home, but what's also really helped me is not only my family experience, but our team members sharing their family experience and their needs as all this craziness with schools and, you know, all the stuff that's going on. Just the whole education, childcare, that dynamic for our team members and our parents, difficult. And so I'm grateful for the power of people being candid about their needs, including my family, and just bringing those together in a way that has helped us work, all of us, during quarantine. So that's one big bucket of things I'm grateful for. Another thing I'm grateful for is, you know, platforms that allow
us to connect with each other, Clubhouse being a really big one, quite honestly. I've been a large-scale public speaker for many, many years. I was constantly at events for my industry and for others. I'm a coffee shop junkie. I love people. I'm actually in the middle of introvert and extrovert. I'm not a full extrovert. I'm like right on the line, but I still love people, and I love the one-on-one time with people and the serendipitous connections that I would have in a lobby at an event or at a coffee shop. And a platform like this has honestly filled that little hole in my heart, and I love it. And even if events and going places becomes more common, I don't know that that will replace this new kind of connection, because I am in like my athleisure sitting on my couch and my babies are in bed and I'm getting to connect with, I don't have to leave my home to connect with all of you.
Yeah.
And that's fucking dope, right? Like that's amazing. And so that I'll say that's a second thing that's been helpful during quarantine. And then the third thing that's been helpful, because all of it, all of what our world, but particularly our country, is going through is just, it's heavy, man. It's heavy. Is just people doing good, you know, and sharing it in whatever way they're comfortable sharing it. People trying to be a part of something, trying to help others, you know, the helpers. A little bit of the, one of the sessions that was had here earlier on how to citizen, you know, people being called to more citizenry, being called to lead. That's helpful. You know, it's inspiring, it's beautiful, it's motivating. And so those are three things that I think have been really helpful during this time.
Fantastic. Actually, for the sake of time, I'll actually ask you which one you want to go to. Do you want to go to the learning segment or lightning round and then open it up to questions?
Let's go lightning round and questions. If there's anybody here who's been hanging that'd love to come up, I would love to connect with folks.
Cool. So this is called the lightning round. I'm going to ask you this or that questions. Pancakes or waffles?
Pancakes all day.
Dogs or cats? Both is also an answer.
Both. Equal.
Okay, there you go. West Coast or East Coast?
Both. I'm at home everywhere.
Okay, cool. I'm a West Coast person personally, but I haven't lived on the East Coast, so there's that. City or suburbs?
City.
Netflix or YouTube?
Depends on the season. I'm in a Netflix season right now, but it varies, so Netflix.
Got it. And the last one is phone calls or texts?
I prefer phone calls, but I actually text more. Isn't that interesting?
That is kind of interesting.
Just the way of the world, I suppose.
Yeah. I think there's the lost art of a phone call. Like some of my friends, I'll call them and they'll be like, what? Are you okay? Are you safe? Where are you? Did you get into an accident? Da, da, da. And I'm like, no, I'm just checking in.
I don't know if I would have said that before Clubhouse, though.
I agree.
There's something about being on voice more that has made it has worked that muscle to where the humanity of it, the personal nature of it. So maybe if you had said voice, not phone call, but voice or text, I'd say voice hands down, because I was also a voice note person
before Clubhouse. I've never used voice notes personally.
What?
Yeah, I don't know. I've done like long phone calls with people, but I think the people that I know outside of Clubhouse, like I want to say in real life as if that's different, but like in person, I guess, the majority of them don't call each other just to like check in. I think that's just like a cultural thing that is just somewhat of a lost art. And we'll just text each other to keep in touch.
Try it sometime.
I should. Yeah, totally. I think I did one and I just found myself fumbling. Part of the reason I made this podcast is to get better at like long form talking, because I've been told in general feedback over the course of my very short career that like I'm not good at long form talking. And so a voice note is basically like the most intimidating thing, because it's literally long form talking of like sending a minute or like recording a minute or two of like leaving a long voicemail. And like even leaving a voicemail for me is like anxiety producing.
Oh,
So.
Give yourself a much smaller container. 20 seconds. 20 seconds.
I'll try it out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this is the part of the podcast where we open it up to anyone in the audience. If you have any questions for Kat or I, feel free to raise your hand. Just another reminder, the room is being recorded. So don't say anything that you don't want to put out into the universe. We'll keep this open for about 15 to 20 minutes-ish, somewhere around there. And then close out the podcast, stop recording, and then close the room. Welcome, Lynette.
Hi, Lynette.
Hey. Wow. I wanted to give you your flowers. I've already retweeted some just gems that you dropped during this podcast. We have quite a bit in common, and I just wanted to thank you so much for mentioning about how crucial it is for a lot of kids in college, you know, to have different restaurant jobs. I'm in food now, but I was in art school before. And, you know, in between photo projects and whatnot, I worked at all types of different restaurants, and the absolute best one was Hooters in New York City. So I'm so
amazing.
I'm so stoked. I don't ever really get to share that much because it just seems so odd. But I think I learned a lot of the same things that you did, and now I'm applying these to my food business. Like, that was a franchise. Yeah. That was such a structure that I learned all of my gourmet stuff at the gourmet place, but how to run a food business at Hooters, absolutely. Like, if you didn't match the socks, girl, you had to go home.
That's right.
You know, you had to go home. And so I thought that was super awesome, you know, because you don't really get a chance to kind of share that. And thank you so much for telling your story. And PTR, I just changed it to my shorts. I still run it. we gotta sing the birthday. Can we sing a birthday song later on tonight, please?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, all right, I'm gonna hop back down to the audience. Thanks, Shadow, for doing this. This is great.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you, Lynette. And I always love hearing your voice in rooms. You are such a light.
That was so cool.
That was amazing.
Anyone else, if you have a question, feel free to raise your hand, and I'll pop you up.
Yeah, and I'll build on Lynette's comments. You know, just the training that you get from being in the food business, but then also the service industry, and then a franchise where there needs to be consistency across a brand and distributed locations. It's a serious training ground if you're paying attention, right? Some people aren't paying attention. Some people are like, oh, I'm just here. It's cool. But if you're paying attention, that environment from a business perspective really colors your thinking. So there's the benefit of being a server and understanding customer service and really getting like how important the customer is to the business. There's the understanding of a complex operation. It's a production facility. Every restaurant is a production facility. You have to order. You have to get the pars right. You have to make sure the shelf life is right. Then you have to have preparation. And then you have to have the labor scheduled to do all of that. And then the food has to be ready. You know, it's just like it's a really complex production facility. And I worked every job. I was a Hooters girl. I was a hostess. I was a bartender. I was a cook. I was a manager. And that's an incredible training ground for understanding an entire value chain of a business. And then the fact that it's a franchise with a brand that has brand standards, where it's not just recreating over and over. There's a level of both commitment to the outcome that's required, but compliance to a standard. And that definitely has staying power from both a leadership and a business planning perspective. What's up, Jason?
Hey, Kat. This has just been terrific. This is one of the best hour pluses I've spent on Clubhouse. I could listen to you speak.
Yay!
I noticed on your Twitter bio that you do work with the UN Foundation. I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, how that sort of got into your life, what work you do with them, and then just selfishly, I was willing to pro bono coach me because I would just love to have every single like week here.
Every week might be a little heavy for pro bono. Well, always down for a conversation. You know, the UN Foundation, like many things, is just a culmination of many things I did. Like my humanitarian journey started as volunteering in soup kitchens in Atlanta. And I fell in love with volunteerism. It was a way to bring myself joy when work was really hard. And then I was so entwined in the giving community in Atlanta that I wove volunteering through the fabric of our manager training. So it's still, from what I understand, part of it today. That part of the week-long manager training at the corporate office includes a half a day going down to the shelter, bringing wings, feeding people, remembering, you know, that, and also keeping things in perspective and how fortunate we are, and to inspire them to go do similar things back in their communities. And so it started there, and then led to other types of nonprofit leader. Randomly, I ended up doing nonprofit work in Rwanda 12 years ago, and I've done work in Eastern Africa for many years. It started out as mentoring women and one of President Kagame's initiatives to elevate and educate women. Then it turned into women mentoring women in tech, because many people don't realize that behind Kenya, Rwanda is, in the early days, was one of the most advanced countries in implementing technology in Eastern Africa and in the whole of Africa in some ways. And so I ended up doing a lot of tech work there, mentoring founders. And then that led to someone saying, hey, you've done work in Eastern Africa, you understand the region, could you come with me, a friend of mine, to Ethiopia and do village work? So, you know, that one thing led to another is the point. And so between my business experience and my global humanitarian work that started very homegrown, I was recruited by the UN to work on their Global Entrepreneurs Council, which is a group of people that have been brought together over the years for a 2-year commitment to work on some of the world's hardest problems. So we were working on the refugee crisis and bringing entrepreneurial thinking to some of the world's largest refugee camps, and then working on campaigns that helped refugees be integrated into cities, get out of refugee camps, and some policy work that was pro-refugee in the United States back then. So that's how the UN work evolved.
If anyone has a question, feel free to raise your hand. While we're waiting, I have one question for you, Kat, or I guess two. How do you figure out prioritization across like pro bono, nonprofits, everything with focus brands, doing office hours on Clubhouse, being an advocate for many different things across the board? How do you figure, and as well as having a family that you're taking care of, how do you figure out prioritization in your head of where I can, where, how to figure out your time allocation? Because everyone has 24 hours in a day that they need to, yeah, you know, to take, that's the amount of time. Some people, like my sister, says that I have the same hours in a day as Beyonce does. I don't know if that's the best way of looking at it, but I feel like everyone has the same amount of time. But when you're looking at that finite amount of time, how do you figure out prioritization when you have so many different things you're trying to take care of?
One is tuned to my values. And so my husband and I have quarterly offsites. We do monthly check-ins with each other, and we have a quarterly offsite, and we just check in with each other and ourselves around our values. What are our values? What's important to us? And is the way we're spending our time commensurate with that? And just that consciousness is incredibly helpful in driving prioritization, and not only the consciousness, but the feedback opportunities to give myself feedback and just ask and reflect, but also get feedback from people who are close enough to be paying attention. My husband being one of those people, my leadership teams that work for me being others, friends, etc. And so that's a big foundation of it. And then next is I don't hold myself to an impossible standard. I mean, on one hand, yes, I have the same hours in a day as Beyonce, but I am not the magic queen that she is. All hail Queen Bey. And, you know, don't have bazillions and bazillions of people working on teams to do things for me in that way. And so I use it as inspiration, but not something that makes me feel less than, and or that is so motivating that it just drives me in. So I try to keep my pendulum from swinging too far to either side. On one hand, I don't want it to be so far on the side of I need to do more, I need to do more, that I burn myself out. I also don't want it to be so far on that it's all good, that I miss really great opportunities to grow as a person. So I think giving myself that permission to be on a journey is the other part of it, and just try to spend my energy on things that give me energy, and fewer things over the years that, you know, I spend my time less and less on things that drain my energy. And so back to your point of paid versus pro bono, you know, that's what it's about. Like, I am giving energy to Clubhouse, but I am receiving energy to Clubhouse. It is joyful to me to connect in this way. And when I mentor people, I have 4 to 5 just calls with people I've met here on other platforms that are just learning from people and sharing my experience and learning from them. And then there are times when people want to get that learning more regularly, and my experience has value and I know it. And I don't give away my value in situations where I shouldn't, you know, where someone else is then growing and profiting off of it. Well, then I'll be your advisor and you can pay me for that. or I'll take equity in your company and that's the way you can pay me for that. So there's, you know, there's a line, and you try to read it at any given point as accurately as you can. But certainly my North Star is to give first. And then if something seems of value and people want more of it, then that's when it would shift from a once in a while give of my time to, okay, this is now a formal thing and that commands value, and so you should pay for it.
That makes sense. Speaking of giving, welcome to Mir. Yeah. We're going to give the floor to you. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Sure. Hey, Kat. Great hearing your story. I'm sure you hear this quite a bit. I first heard your story in Undercover Bosses. Really, my question is around your perspective coming, as someone who's been operating larger brands and working with smaller startups as an investor, and I'm sure as an advisor to many. And for full context, I've led operations at early stage sort of DTC brands such as Walker & Co., Bevel, Quip, the oral care subscription company, and now starting my own brand as well with my wife. But
awesome.
Yeah, thank you. And my question, coming from a larger company, having that perspective as with these larger brands, what have you seen from your perspective works mostly for successful startups that you're advising? Like, what are traits in those companies and the way they operate and the way they scale that makes them more successful than others?
One is just an obsession with the customer. They're so clear. They're so clear on the lived experience of their customer, and not exclusively a focus on the customer, because, you know, sometimes an idea and or a product or a service that's really fantastic before people know that they need it. So you can't always rely on what the customer says to be the guiding light of the most successful companies, but it is a large percentage of a common trait of the most successful companies, even of those that we buy, right? We buy companies sometimes from founders. Now they're scaled at that point.
Right.
But just the decisions that are being made have their root in a desired experience for a customer instead of, simply the whims or the misguided ideas of people in the company. Again, that doesn't remove the fact that there is such a thing as founder genius, and people find market before a large group of customers could ever say that they want it or give feedback. But once they do launch that genius thing, even if it's ahead of its time a bit, still you have to listen to the customer, right? And so it is finding the way to delight the most loyal fans and learn from them and then repeat and move concentric circles out in terms of customer targeting, whether it's B2B, B2C, or B2B2C. That's a really smart and efficient way to grow a business, like hit the bullseye and then work on growing it out instead of shotgun, try to be all things to all people. So that's one common trait. And the other is what I referenced earlier, which is just the team, you know, the ability to, even at small stages, but during high growth, identify really great talent and keep them engaged, have them aligned in the mission, and not have people in the wrong roles for too long, which sometimes doesn't mean letting them go. It means getting them in the right role in the company. But those two things together, it's sort of like customer and employee, customer and team, and continually optimizing for it, that those seem to be really common traits between the most successful brands and companies.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you very much. Really appreciate hearing your story. Thanks.
Yeah, you got it. Thanks, Mir. Good luck with your brands.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Kat, I think we're a little over an hour here, so we'll do maybe one last question, and then I'll close out the pod and stop recording. Okay. So if anyone wants to raise their hand, just another quick reminder, we'll be recording for probably the next, like, 5-10 minutes, and then I'll stop recording and then open the room up to do whatever we want. So if you have a question, feel free to raise your hand, and we'll bump you to the speaker box for the last question for the podcast.
And in the meantime, you can throw your question my way, Shardul, since we're wrapping up.
Oh, yeah. The last one I had, which is, I don't know how better way to word this, but just listening to you during office hours, different rooms in here, I worded it and I was like, there's no, it's a very like blunt question, but it's like, how'd you get so good at talking?
I did a lot of listening. You know, I pay attention to people. And when I first started traveling around the world, I had a super heavy Southern accent. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. And when I would travel to other countries where people, English wasn't the first language, but many people spoke English. They spoke English beautifully, better than I did. They could not understand me because my accent was so heavy. And I learned by necessity to articulate. Most people now, when I travel, they say, I can't tell where you're from, which makes me a little bit sad because I love hearing accents and hearing and, you know, the color and the beauty in people's tone. But I was in so many countries so often that it was a severe hindrance to my work. And so it was like water shaping rock. People would ask me things over and over and over. And I just slowly learned not only how I wanted to say things clearly so they could be understood, but I learned to focus on saying whatever was the least that could be said to make a point. And it also helped as I learned other languages, or at least enough to communicate it. You know, it's hard when you're learning another language in another country. It makes me very self-conscious because my robust vocabulary in English, I don't have in any other language. And so I just got comfortable with being brief and to the point. And so that helps with, I think, my clarity of communication. And I've had a full life, man. I've lived a lot of experiences and made a ton of mistakes. And I speak from the heart. I care deeply about people. And no matter the setting, whether it's this, you know, Clubhouse or a speech or a team meeting with three people, I care more about the experience of those I'm around than I care about me, about how I sound. It's funny when people say, oh, I'm so worried about speaking. I'm so worried about how I come across. Really what's under that in many cases is ego, not ego in the normal bravado sense, but meaning what that says is for a moment, and maybe for very good reasons, you know, I'm more worried about how I come across than I am about the experience of those I'm with. And I just threw that away a long time ago and did not give that any oxygen. And I just care deeply about what people hear and how they feel it. And I try to hear myself and only give what I think adds value and leave unsaid what doesn't. And so I think that's part of it. But, you know, being a good speaker often comes from being a great listener and then making it more about the experience of others than what you think you have to get across, in my experience.
I love that. And brief like anecdote is I'm in my mid-20s. I grew up in Indian culture. There's this saying that my parents, and then I think like Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj actually like popularized this a little bit more. There's this saying of like, what will other people think? It's lo kya kahenge. And like, whatever you do, what will other people think of you? Whether that's talking or putting yourself out there or asking for help or showing weakness, etc. There's definitely this like layer of at least the culture I grew up in where my parents would say, don't do that, what will people think? Or don't do that, right? And
Yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah. Part of the podcast has been for me just trying to learn in public and learning from other people and listening to people like yourself and a bunch of other guests I've had on the pod to learn like how did they approach different things over their life and how have they put themselves out there and not really worried what people think, but at the same time been very cognizant of what other people think.
Yeah, I think so. Back to the beginning of this, you know, that phrase that I live by, the don't forget where you came from, but don't let it solely define you. You know, that phrase is powerful and it's ingrained in you, it sounds like, and it will never leave. So instead of fighting it, compliment it. So yes, you are trained to be concerned about what people think, but then add to that being deeply committed to really optimizing what they feel and not so much about what they think about you, but what they can think, feel, and do as a result, you know, of your time. But it's been great to chat and thank you for taking the time on Clubhouse. I always love sharing and hearing people's questions and sharing some lessons along the way. And anyone's welcome to hit me up. DMs are open. I host office hours on Wednesdays at 9 Pacific, 12 Eastern, and it's just workshopping what's going on in the world, leadership, business topics. Sometimes I have a guest, sometimes I don't. Super open. So hope to see some of you there on Wednesday. And thanks so much for this, Shardul.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Hope everybody has a great week.
This was so good. Thank you so much for taking some time out of your day. I know we had some, we had to figure out scheduling, but the last thing I had was any causes or things that you'd like to shout out or any CTAs for people aside from office hours.
Yes, the 99 Problems group and Up to Us 2020, that the whole, you know, all the movement helping to protect our democracy and get people out to vote. My favorite stuff going on right now, truly in the world, and a lot of it born out of Clubhouse. So that's it. If people don't know about it, if they're new to Clubhouse, check out the 99 Problems Club. Look up to Us 2020. On Twitter. They're fantastic groups and movements, shining a light on other organizations and then doing their own work to get people out to vote.
That's it for another edition of Three Good Things. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll see you tomorrow.